Welcome back to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. My guest today is Pulitzer Prize-winning author John Meacham. We're talking about his new book, Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. In writing the book over a period of more than a decade, Meacham conducted countless hours of interviews with George and Barbara Bush, members of their family, and people who worked with Mr. Bush in his many government positions. Meacham also became the first journalist to be given access to the many hours of taped diaries that Bush recorded from the 1960s well into the 90s. His father, Prescott Bush, who, by the way, what's the exact quote? Dad, tall, you
tall,
said,
scary, respected, tall, scary, respected.
Very big guy.
Very big guy. 6'4".
So his dad decides to run for United States Senate. He's a moderate Republican.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
But here's what I think is funny about that. And he's elected. But I've heard you on a number of occasions joke about the fact that you being in the room with the Bushes is just it's like a wasp fest.
Wasp on wasp therapy, yeah.
And so I thought about that when I read, you quoted the lyrics of one of Prescott Bush's, this is a campaign song?
Yes, the campaign song.
Can I read it?
Please, please.
This was actually a campaign song.
This was out there, you know, to try to convince the good people of Connecticut that this was their man.
And I read it because it illuminates you're talking about the wasp culture. Some churchmen think his program odd. First Yale, now country. When for God? They really shouldn't give up hope. In 10 years more, he may be Pope. Well, that's a little out of keeping. His speeches, like his rise, will be right down the center of the tee. His only leftist tendency is when he hooks around the tree. Boy, that says it all, John.
Senator Bush was Eisenhower's favorite golfing partner in the Senate. What he loved is, A, Prescott Bush was a fabulous golfer, was one thing. But the other thing is that Eisenhower appreciated that Bush didn't want to talk business, and that if he did say something, if Eisenhower did say something, it would never leak. So, like father, like son. His father adored the Senate and was a moderate to liberal Republican, was part of a move to get Nixon off the ticket in 56 with Eisenhower. He was fairly progressive on civil rights. He was a federal interstate highway guy. And most significantly, was a someone who spoke out against Joe McCarthy early.
So in 1941, George meets at a Christmas dance at the Greenwich Country Club.
Right. Barbara Pierce.
Barbara Pierce. Who was Barbara Pierce in those days? What kind of was she in those days?
She was a debutante girl from Rye, New York. Her father was the publisher of McCall's, a big publishing company. She was wearing a red and green holiday dress. Bush never remembered anything, but he did remember that. He asked her to dance and asked to be introduced to her, asked her to dance. They were going to waltz, and he said, "I don't waltz." And so they sat down and started talking, and as Mrs. Bush says, George has since joked that I haven't stopped talking since.
you report that on the first date, he borrowed an Oldsmobile because it had a radio in it. Why did he want a radio in the car?
To fill any uncomfortable silences, not realizing that Mrs. Bush would never allow an uncomfortable silence.
And that was it.
That was it. That was it. They married on January 6, 1945. He was getting ready. This is something else we forget. He was getting ready to go back in 1945 for the invasion of the Home Islands when the bomb was dropped in VJ Day. They were in Norfolk. He had rejoined his squadron. And then George W. was born in 1946.
Despite the sweep of his life, of your biography of him, that the very heart of this book is the story of Robin.
Yeah.
Talk about Robin a little bit. Who was she?
Born in 1949, Pauline Robinson Bush was their second child after George W. When she was 4 years old, she was lethargic and bruising. They were living in Midland, Texas at the time. Mrs. Bush took her to the pediatrician. The pediatrician diagnosed her with leukemia. Bush was at the Ector County Courthouse checking on oil leases when Barbara called and said, "We have to go to the doctor." And the doctor was crying and could barely control herself as she told the Bushes, and they'd never heard the word leukemia before. He then picks up the phone and calls. The doctor in Midland says, "Just take her home and make her comfortable, and she'll be gone in a few months." Bush refuses that. Calls his uncle John Walker, who was a doctor at Memorial Sloan Kettering, head of Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York. They took her to New York, and she lived about 6 or 7 months after that. Died in early October 1953, and they will be, both Bushes will be buried with Robin. Robin was buried in Greenwich.
Well, let's talk about that, because there's a very moving story as Robin is dying. Prescott Bush comes to Barbara Bush and says, "Oh, I've bought a burial plot, my burial plot, and I want to show it to you."
Right, right? Exactly. So Senator Bush exactly says to Barbara, "I want to show you. I bought this for me and Dottie, Mrs. Bush." But Barbara realizes that what he's done is he's bought it for Robin.
Yeah.
And she is buried there ultimately. And but in the then about 50 years later or so, right after when the president's burial plot at College Station has been prepared, they bring her back and bring her to Texas and reinter her there.
You were given a letter among many of the papers you saw of his. Why did he write this letter? Who is he writing to?
This is a letter that he wrote in the late 1950s. He's in New York on business, and what he'd been doing when he'd been there on business before is he clearly had gone to Greenwich to her grave, to Robin's grave, and it had not gone this particular time. And then he wrote a letter to his mother about the four sons. It's now George W., Jeb, Neil, and Marvin. And this is the letter. "There is about our house a need. The running, pulsating restlessness of the four boys needs a counterpart. We need some starch crisp frocks to go with all our blue jeans and helmets. We need some soft blonde hair to offset those crew cuts. We need a dollhouse to stand firm against our forts and rackets and baseball cards. We need a legitimate Christmas angel, one who doesn't have cuffs beneath the dress. We need someone who's afraid of frogs. We need someone to cry when I get mad, not argue. We need a little one who can kiss without leaving egg or jam or gum. We need a girl. We had one once. She'd fight and cry and play and make her way just like the rest. But there was about her a certain softness. She was patient. Her hugs were just a little less wiggly. Like them, she'd climb in to sleep with me, but somehow she'd fit. She'd stand beside our bed till I felt her there. Silently and comfortable, she'd put those precious fragrant locks against my chest and fall asleep. Her peace made me feel strong, and so very important. My daddy had a caress, a certain ownership, which touched a slightly different spot than the "Hi, Dad" I love so much. But she is still with us. We need her, and yet we have her. We can't touch her, and yet we can feel her. We hope she'll stay in our house for a long, long time." When I, in the course of interviewing the president, I asked him to read that out loud to me, and he broke down long before he finished with distinctly physical sobs, so much so that his chief of staff, whose office was next door, heard what was going on and came in, and she asked me, she said, "Why did you want President Bush to read that?" And I said, "Because if you want to know someone's heart," and before I could finish the sentence, the president said, "You have to know what breaks it." And he knew where my sentence was going way that maybe even I didn't.
It obviously reveals a lot to us about his emotions. And in some ways, the reason I say it for me, in some ways it was the center of the book, is because it's certainly the rawest that we see him and recognize how deeply, deeply, deeply this man feels, this man who's often been kind of this figure that we don't know and understand.
Right. You know, the man who seemed to be out of touch at a supermarket scanner or, you know, looking at his watch and all that. I mean, politics is unfair. He knows that. But to caricature him as an out-of-touch aristocrat is to miss the core of a really fascinating president.
Well, the other thing that is wonderful about that letter is this is the guy who people don't think is very articulate.
Oh, I know.
That is a beautifully written letter.
Absolutely.
It's gorgeous imagery.
Absolutely. He totally gets it. And did this all his life. I mean, wrote wonderful letters. Was unable, I think, to articulate his emotion verbally, but he wrote incredibly well. And my grandfather was like this. My grandfather would no more tell you something of an emotional nature than he could fly. But he wrote letters that were affecting. I think it's a generational thing.
At one point, Richard Nixon wanted to bring George Bush into the White House as an aide. I assume he would have been in the inner circle. Perhaps.
To work for Bob Haldeman.
With Bob Haldeman, John Ehrlichman. And instead, he decides to send him...
to the U.N.
To the U.N. What would have happened to the career of George Herbert Walker Bush if he'd been in the White House?
With the tapes rolling.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those wonderful counterfactual moments. Can you imagine a Nixon White House aide? It was close enough. I mean, when Bush became chairman of the RNC 2 years later. But working for Bob Haldeman, I mean, most of those guys went to prison. Now, I think Bush would have... done the right thing and all that, but by his guilt by association, having been an assistant to the president, and wonderfully, there's a dorky little detail in here. One of the reasons Nixon agreed to send him to New York was that he wanted Bush to actually live in Connecticut, establish residency, and then run for the Senate from Connecticut, since Bush had lost twice in Texas. It shows that Nixon never drew a non-political breath.
Okay, so now let's go to 1976. Bush is at this point head of the CIA. Jimmy Carter is the Democratic nominee for president. And he asks for a national security briefing or for a global security briefing. Yep. And George Bush comes to Plains, Georgia.
Yep.
What's that experience?
President
like?
Carter, Governor Carter at the time, was the first nominee, we think, to ask for this. Even before he was the nominee, he wanted these briefings. And Bush gave them to him. President Ford agreed, and Bush delivered them in person, usually with a team. But once Carter wins, Bush calls him and resigns. But then, on a visit to Plains, reopens the question about whether Bush should stay on for a year or so as director of the CIA. Carter showed no interest, and the conversation moved on. President Carter told me, actually, I was in Plains. I went and saw him teach Sunday school. It was a Sunday. Then that afternoon, I went over to interview him for this book. And he said George Bush was sitting exactly where you're sitting on the couch at their house, and if I had acceded to his request, he would never have been president, because a Carter administration official would not have found his way
favor in the Republican Party
to a ticket in 1980.
Well, there was some foreshadowing that Carter might not keep him on in that job, because he had a little conversation with Miss Lillian when he was down there during the campaign.
Miss Lillian told the New York Times that Jimmy was going to get rid of all the Republicans, including Bush. But he appreciated strong women. Bush understood that.
So let's move forward. George Bush obviously won the presidency in 1988. Served one term, 4 years in the White House. In a couple of sentences, how do you sum up those 4 years?
Well, it was 8 years of action compressed into four. domestically, he passed the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Clean Air Act, the 1990 budget deal, which set up the surpluses of the 1990s. In foreign policy, he dealt with Tiananmen Square, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the first Gulf War, the end of the Cold War, the end of the Bolshevik Revolution on Christmas Day, 1991. He negotiated NAFTA, and he reunified Germany. And his term can be pretty safely bifurcated into two. The first 2 years were enormously productive. The last two were less so. We went into a mild but persistent recession. The recovery was not strong. 1992 was a perfect storm of bad news for him. Pat Buchanan ran against him, challenged him, won 40% in New Hampshire. And Bill Clinton is one of the most talented politicians in American history. And so just everywhere he turned, everywhere Bush turned in 1992, he just was not, nothing was working.
My guest is author John Meacham. We're talking about his new biography of George H.W. Bush, or Bush 41, as he's known to distinguish him from his son, President George W. Bush. More with Meacham in a moment.